owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. As you can hear from the background, it's a little bit noisy, and that's because we're on the road again. We're very pleased to be hosted by the 390th Memorial Museum here in Tucson, Arizona. No matter where you are around the world, if you like history and you like planes, I'd highly recommend you pay a visit to the Memorial Museum. It's really a museum within a museum. It's focused on telling the deeply personal stories of the members of the 390th Bomb Group. Now, if you know me, you know I'm a big fan of history, and I'm a big fan in the power of storytelling. So what we're going to do today is I brought on a special guest who is also a very powerful storyteller, and we're going to interview a young man who you might have heard on American Warrior Radio before, Colonel Dick Bouchon. There was just an amazing presentation took place here at the 390th Memorial Museum. So without further ado, let me introduce you to John Mullinson. John, you are, earlier today, the phrase history geek was was used on several occasions. Like me, though, you never served. So why do you do this?
Well, we have a saying at my little production company that history is nutritious. And I've been very fortunate. I've been in business, and I've seen the power of what happens when employees understand the legacy and the meaning of the people who've gone before them. So this is it's a calling for me, I guess you could call it that.
Now, you grew up in North Dakota, and I could tell you that you're an adventurous sort of soul, because when it came time for you to go somewhere, you went all the way south to South Dakota?
Yes, yeah, South Dakota, where the winters are a little warmer.
What's that, like 20 miles?
Actually, it was 120 miles. But, yeah, it was much warmer winters. I went from minus 40 below to minus 20.
I spent a winter in South Dakota, so I hear you, brother. What you do, and if folks, I encourage you, if you're listening to our show live or if you hear it in one of our other affiliates around the country a little bit later or listen to the podcast, go to 390th.org. They're going to put up a video of today's ceremonies and this interview. You'll get to see Colonel Bouchon. And you also get to see just this tremendous artwork that John does. He draws these amazing photographs of these aircraft, and what makes them special is it's not just a drawing, a piece of artwork about the machine. It's about the person or persons and their stories behind that machine. In this case, it was Colonel Bouchon's last mission, the 28th mission he flew to Berlin, and just barely made it home. So, John, real quick, before we get to the Colonel, how many of these paintings are there, or not paintings, artwork are there around the world?
Hey, oh, geez. You've been here before.
They tell me in at least 14 countries. I'd say thousands. I've been very fortunate. I'm a prolific artist, and there are history geeks in at least 14 countries in the world.
And what do you, mostly all vintage of aircraft, right? Have you got a Sopwith Camel in there somewhere, or maybe not?
I meet the pilot, like Colonel Bouchon here. I meet the pilot, and they sign the prints of my artwork, and they're the people who truly make it valuable.
Okay, well,
good segue here.
Yeah, I think we should talk to the man. And Colonel, I got to tell you, I've been out here so many times. You've been on American Warrior Radio. I've been out here so many times for events with you that I think you need maybe an agent. I think the Hollywood folks are going to come knocking on the door any minute, Colonel.
Yeah, there we go.
Well, Colonel, you're a pro, and as much as I'm a control freak, I'm going to turn this over to you, and I'll let you know when we need to take a break, and all yours, sir.
Well, good. Colonel Bouchon, I have an elevator speech, and it's something that if you ever meet me in the elevator, they ask me what I do. I say I interview old guys, and I draw their airplanes. But you are so not an old guy. Where did you get your attitude for youth and vigor?
Well, it's my younger girlfriend. I'm 98 years old, but I have a younger girlfriend. She's 93.
Look, I got to ask you, when did you meet her?
Oh, about 14 years ago.
Okay.
And we live in the same complex down in Green Valley. And so I was introduced to her by some friends. Yeah. And we've been friends ever since. So we go a lot of places together. And we used to go to reunions together and those kind of things all over the nation, but traveling is a little too hard for me now.
Right. How many people in the 390th, your mom group, are still with us?
Not very many. At the last reunion, last October, I saw three other veterans.
Really?
And one of them was 103 years old, so I don't know if he's still living or not. But I'm just a kid. I'm only 98.
Well, I've got a question that I ask everybody, every old guy. All right, so here it is. If you could go back in time and meet yourself when you're 21 years old and you're flying this gorgeous B-17 that's right behind you, and for the people who need visuals, the inboard starboard engine is just right above Colonel Bouchon here. It's really cool. But if you were to go back in time to yourself at 21, what kind of life advice would you give yourself?
Oh, when I finished that tour, and very lucky to do so, I went over with 35 crews. Only 12 and a half got to go home.
Yeah.
So I would say you're very lucky, but work hard. Work hard, and I did. When I came back to the States, I went through test pilot school, and then I was assigned to Boeing factory in Wichita where they were making B-29. So I was an Army Air Force test pilot on B-29. And then later in my career, they said, oh, you've been to test pilot school. You know all about airplanes. You are a maintenance officer. So I was an aircraft maintenance officer for years and worked my way up to deputy commander for logistics.
Who taught you? Who gave you those kind of values of hard work? And what does that mean to work hard?
My dad was a hard worker, and my mom, too. He would work all day at the paper mill where he worked and then come home and do four or five more hours of work around our place. Always busy. And, of course, he got me busy. I worked hard, too, when I was a kid. So I enjoyed working, and it paid off. I worked hard.
Do you have grandkids?
Yes, I do. I just have three grandkids and four great-grandkids.
Okay, here's another question to ask you. Have you given them any advice about how to be successful in life? And if you have, what would you tell them, or what did you tell them?
Whatever you do, work hard at it. Do it right and work hard. I get chastised by my younger girlfriend because I want things to be right all the time. And they're not always, you know, people do things wrong. And I can't stand it when somebody does things incorrectly.
Would you say you're a perfectionist?
I am, yeah.
But you seem positive. It's not like the negative kind of perfectionism.
Oh, no, I'm positive. Yeah, and I enjoy what I'm doing. I've worked here at the museum for 29 years.
Right.
Every Thursday that I could.
Right.
I had to take a few off when I got both knees replaced. And
you had both knees replaced?
At the same time.
That doesn't sound like a great plan.
Oh, golly, no. I have the video of it, and my daughter just brought it back to me. So I'm going to get to watch that video.
Yeah.
He wanted to take a video because he was an instructor at the university over here in orthopedics. And he said, since we're doing both of them at the same time, can I photograph it? And I said, yeah, if you give me a copy. So I have a copy of it.
So you were a guinea pig.
Sort of, yeah. But now here I am, 98 years old, and I'm fairly good condition, doing fine.
Oh, you're looking great. What we're going to do pretty soon here is we're going to go to a commercial break, and then I've got a very, very serious question to ask of you, and you're just in a great mood, so I want you to think we're going to have a 4-minute break here?
Thereabouts,
yeah. Yeah, thereabouts. Okay, so I'll ask the question, though, because I want to talk to you about it. So all the listeners, you want to stand by. We've got a we've got a powerful moment coming up, I hope.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're tuned in to American Warrior Radio. You're hearing the voice of John Mollison. Look up oldguysintheirairplanes.com. Just some amazing videos there and interviews. And we're talking with Colonel Richard Bouchong. They're honoring him here at the 390th Memorial Museum. There's John, there must be more distinguished flying crosses in this room than maybe a DFC reunion.
Oh, yeah. If they were wearing them and they went swimming, they'd sink to the bottom.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned. We'll be right back after these messages. More with John Mollison and Colonel Richard Bouchong. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I got to tell you, folks, we're broadcasting from the 390th Memorial Museum. And for a guy like me, this is like being at a Hollywood premiere and a baseball all-star game and the Academy Awards all at once. Just what a tremendous opportunity here to meet some great people, some great patriots who have protected our country. And we're telling stories. We're telling stories, in this case in particular, about a young man, 98-year-old young man, Colonel Richard Bouchong. He was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross after bringing his plane and his crew safely home from a mission over Berlin. Plane pretty well shot up. Dick, you were flying on one engine, one and a half engines.
Well, I had two running.
Two running engines. And we're very pleased to have a true professional interviewing Colonel Bouchong today, John Mollison, who is the John, founder, executive director, what is your title of Old Guys and Their Planes?
Head cook and bottle washer.
Head cook and bottle washer is good.
No, I'm part of a team.
An army travels on its stomach, so that's important. So, ladies and gentlemen, you can find out more at oldguysintheirairplanes.com. Also, John is a very talented artist, and he has done, there's 30 prints that he's done, or he did one drawing of Colonel Bouchong's airplane. And they're autographed by both you and the Colonel, and they're being sold as a fundraiser for the 390th. Folks can go online, find that if there's any left after today. But, folks, you want to go to 390th.org to check that out. John, back to you.
Yeah, thank you. And, by the way, this is like a movie premiere. I have to ask you, Colonel, is when you see all this attention, they're all showing up for you. And what do you think about that?
Oh, I enjoyed it. They had a big celebration here at the museum for my birthday. This surprised me.
Yeah.
I thought it would be a cake. No, they had chairs out here and DIVs all over the place. And they had a representative from the governor, three mayors, and they all gave me proclamations. And oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
It was quite an event.
You gotta wonder, do you believe in luck?
Boy, do I ever, because to survive 28 missions over there was pure luck.
Really?
Yes. There might have been a little skill involved in flying formation. I got very good at that, but luck. My crew was shot down on their first mission. My crew that I trained with and went over with. I was in the hospital with some bad food, so I like bad food today.
you bring up skill, but surely, I mean, how much training did you get to fly one of these B-17s?
Well, I went through pilot school, of course, and then I was a qualified pilot, but we had about 2.5 months training in the B-17 before we went overseas.
Right.
And so I was co-pilot at first because I was 20 years old, and
right.
The pilot was an old guy. He was 26, real old. And so after I became 21, I got checked out as first pilot and got my own crew.
Okay. I mean, I've got so many questions. I could spend the day with you. But there's a gentleman here in the audience, and he brought his dad's combat diary. And it's all written in that wonderful fountain pen, perfect penmanship that nobody has anymore. And what he was writing about was his psychological profile. Now, here's a question. Do you think that bomber pilots were culled or trained or selected differently than, say, like fighter pilots or recce pilots?
There was one part of us that made us go to bigger airplanes, and that was our height. I was 6 feet tall. when I got the basic flight training in pilot school, that was the middle flying course, they had us get in a line and it tapered. If the guy ahead of you was taller than you, you stop. But if he was shorter, you step forward till the guy ahead of you was taller. So the line tapered like this, and they broke it into four squadrons. These little guys all went to fighter pilot. They all became fighter pilot. We bigger guys went to the big airplanes. So they knew that was going to happen. So they sent us taller guys to twin engine advance rather than single engine advance.
How would what do you think of that?
When we left basic, we went straight into twin engine airplanes with side by side pilot and co-pilot. So we were training then to fly a bigger airplane with a co-pilot and a pilot.
Would you have rather flown fighters?
No, I asked for B-17s because I thought they were such a pretty airplane, but I didn't know they were going to be shooting at me within a couple of months. So.
Okay, so you're the commander of this office.
Yeah, eventually I became the commander. 10 guys on board, 10 crew members.
So what was your responsibility to those 10, or those other 9? I mean, did you feel like you were their father, or was it just you just took whoever you got and you did your job?
No, we were pretty close crew. The crew itself was pretty close together, and we knew each other and knew what our jobs were. And I had my tail gunner got hit on one mission in the knee, tore a chunk of flesh out. And when we got back, they sent him to the hospital, sulfa powdered all the head. He came limping to me about 4 weeks later and said, "I have been to the flight surgeon, and he said I can fly again. Can I fly as your waist gunner because I can't get back there in the tail with this knee?" Now, that guy wanted to go, and he wanted to go with me. And I said, "Yes, you can."
John, and I think that's something, and I encourage folks, when you go, if you get a chance to see these aircraft, we're right in front of a B-17G now. You're here at the third largest aircraft museum in the world, I think. But the perspective and the context is so important. You know, the colonel and 9 other crew members were on this aircraft. If you go look at the wingspan of an F-14 with, what, two crew, maybe one crew, it's about the same. I mean, this was a very small area that you're packing these 10 young men into with people shooting at them. And I think that just speaks to the courage and their commitment to doing what their duty was.
Right.
And we went day after day if necessary. You know, sometimes there would be a space between flights because of weather in the continent. We had to, because we were daylight precision bombers with the Norden bomb sight, we had to see our target. So we didn't have radar in those days on our airplanes. We had one group of B-17s that did have radar, and if we thought that we might possibly have to bomb through the clouds, we would import one of those to be our lead airplane. And so then we could bomb through the clouds, but we preferred to see our target and use that Norden bomb sight.
I got a question, and I got like 10 of them here for you, and I'm actually even getting them on my cell phone. But there's a question about the Norden bomb site. Was it really that accurate, or was that propaganda?
It was at 500 feet, we could put a practice bomb on the target time after time after time, 500 feet. Now we're at 22 or 3 or 4,000 feet. The winds between us and the ground were not the same as they were where we were. So the bombs drifted. So the way we cured that is one group would drop, the lead group, and maybe all of their bombs would drift off to the left of the target, not hit it at all. But the next group, the lead bombardier, saw where those hit, and he deliberately aimed to the right of the target. So his might drift right onto the target.
Right.
So there were 21 behind us, 21 behind them, and we just kept doing it until we got it right.
Is that what they mean when people talk about there was a lead bombardier and the rest are called Togoliers?
Yes.
Okay.
We carried a bombardier on my crew through the entire thing, but later on they decided, well, a gunner could do that job.
Yeah.
And they taught him how to release the bombs, open the bomb bay doors, and do the things necessary, because the lead bombardier was what determined where the bombs were going.
Right. How many times did you return your B-17 with bombs still hung up in the bomb bay?
About twice. I brought a full load back about twice because I was told to bring them back. I didn't really like to bring them back because on my 27th mission, we got into Europe. Therefore, we were in the enemy territory. And we were recalled and said, come back, the whole group, turn around, come back, bring your bombs back. So here we are, still full of fuel, still full of bombs, ammo. We had a lot of stuff that we normally would get rid of. So we had a very heavy airplane to land back in England. And we got shot at, so they counted it as a mission. So
why would that doesn't seem to make sense to bring it. You come back, you burst a tire, you could...
Maybe they were running short on bombs. That may have been the reason.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Ben's telling me we got a second here, and
if the colonel's willing to stay with us, we can keep going. But,
right. Yeah. So we got one more minute.
1 minute till the next break.
1 minute till the next break. Okay. All right. So here's a I'll answer ask a question that I think you can answer quickly. So what was the average altitude that you guys bombed from?
Between 19 and 24,000.
Right.
Well, those were the altitudes that we liked. I did bomb in France. I bombed the B-1 rocket sites and airfield near Paris. And we were only at 12,000. We didn't like that because the flak was more accurate.
Sure.
At the lower level.
Sure.
So we liked it to get up there, you know, as far as we could. I got to 26,000 one day with a heavily loaded airplane. But most of the time we were 24 below.
And below.
Yeah.
Great.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We've got John Mullison, who's also interviewing Colonel Richard Bouchon. And he's got just a couple more questions. Colonel, if you can stay with us a little bit. I know this place is just loaded with fans.
Yeah, they want to see
you. So I'll tell you, when we come back, Colonel, if you'll give us just two more minutes so
sure.
John can wrap up and we'll take care of that.
Ladies
and gentlemen, visit the 390th.org for more information. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're very pleased to be on the road. We're at the 390th Memorial Museum. This is just an amazing museum on the grounds of the Pima Air and Space Museum. No matter where you're hearing this broadcast around the country, I'd encourage you to set a few days aside, come here. Over 400 aircraft at the Pima Air and Space Museum. One aircraft here that we're sitting in front of, but a really special aircraft, a really special, special guy. John, you've got a... One more wrap-up question for Colonel Bouchon.
We
got him.
He's a rock star. The attention in this place, the energy is awesome. I got a question for you, sir, before you go. I know there's some other people who want to interview you and some TV stations, et cetera, but do you think people today are different than when you were a kid?
Yes, I do see a difference between the kids that were same age I was then and what our people did. We accepted a lot of responsibility at a very young age in those days, and I don't know if our young kids could do that. I was 19 when I started pilot training. I wanted to go get in the war and eliminate somebody, the Germans or the Japs. And so I wanted to do that, and I don't know today whether guys really want to do that like they did then.
Why do you think that is? Because I've heard that from a number of, you know, your generation, that people say that people don't have the same level of responsibility or something.
Oh, I don't know what what causes that difference, but I still think there is a difference between our generation and the present generation. I don't know, maybe the upbringing that we had then, hard work, do things, you want to do this, go do it, you know.
Do you think the Depression had anything to do with
it? It may have, yeah. That was a serious time in our life. I talk about going in, we were all skinny, everybody.
Right.
The whole batch of us was skinny in those days. Well, that's not true today.
Right.
Yeah.
It was Alex Wright. He's the head of the museum here. He and I stopped at McDonald's, and we were talking about we can just go up and order food. But back when your generation, you knew how to hunt and prepare and bake your food.
Yep.
And today, nobody knows how to do that.
No, that's right. We had to learn.
Sir, there's a lot of people that want to talk to you, and so I'm going to have to say goodbye. But this has been just a terrific honor, and to see the number of people and the ages and the diversity of everybody here, you've got to know that your legacy is going to live on in many.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And, you know, I'm very fond of this museum. This whole thing was built by 390th veterans, so we're very proud of it. Yeah. And I contribute to it on a regular basis. So,
every Thursday I hear.
Yeah.
Sir, thank you.
Colonel, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Folks, if you want to hear more of Colonel Bushong's story, you're welcome to visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Click on the podcast.
Okay.
Link.
Well, yeah, that's fine.
Give the Colonel time to... Do we need to pipe him out or play a song or something? Or? Anyway, you can visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com, click on the podcast link, and click on the World War II tab, and you'll hear stories by Colonel Bushong and others like him. We're broadcasting from the 390th Memorial Museum. This is just a gorgeous, wonderful museum. It's not just the physical things you can see here, but just the information. This is a personal history of the members of the 390th Bomber Group, and I mean, they literally have got archives where you can look at people who served, you can look up missions. They just opened a brand new display that is just fascinating. They've got bomber jackets that were worn by some of these crew members, and their families donated to the museum. They're absolutely fascinating. All about telling stories, right, John?
You think so. That's how we learn. We tell stories.
I'm fascinated by your... History is nutritious. It's not my first language. Nutritious statement.
Yeah. I'm an ad guy. I come up with copy. I come up with headlines. I came up with that, and then it was like I was speaking somewhere, and somebody came up afterwards and told me that that was a brilliant saying. And I thought, well, it was by accident, but thinking about it, how history nourishes our mind and it gives us perspective. If I can just kind of comment, you know, we teach STEM, and STEM is a good thing. Yeah, we all want
science,
to
technology,
yeah,
engineering and
math. But you think about it, 2 + 2 = 4 everywhere in the universe. But it's learning history that gives us the context of how and why we would want 2 + 2 = 4, or the story of how we learn that. So there's a depth that comes from studying history. And I also think that history teaches you how to have the basic virtues of faith and hope. Because if you can believe that learning will actually affect your outcome, that's a pretty hopeful, faithful statement.
And a key part of that, and it struck me, John, when you were talking to Colonel Bushong about this, that maybe some of the differences between his generation and current generations, you've got to have an inquisitive mind. You've got to want to ask.
Mm-hmm.
And the answers very often for the future are found in history if people bother to look for them. So let me, Ben gets one damn question every show. Here it is.
Right.
So to me it makes perfect sense that a restaurant consultant ad guy got involved in military history. But maybe that path is not as clear to some of our listeners. So what?
Oh, to give you my background.
How did that go? Well, you don't have to tell us a novel, John. Just, I mean, well, what was, maybe here, I'll
You've
got 42 awards and I have none. So let me just, I'll prime the pump here.
Yeah.
My junior year in high school, had to write a book report, small town school. There weren't that many books in the library. I picked a book called Achtung Eagles.
and it was a book about the 4th Fighter Group, the Eagle Squadrons that flew in World War II, mm-hmm. and I was hooked.
Right.
And that just started a litany of wanting to know more and getting to know, and which really led me to the fact that as a civilian, because I never served, it's my duty to support those
right.
who do.
Right.
So that's why we do the show. So was there an aha moment for John like that?
There's really two of them. First of all, as a little kid, I think like a lot of people in history, I was taken by airplanes. My dad built model airplanes. And my mom, when I was 3 years old, would get the box of model airplanes and then put it in front of me with some crayons and a piece of paper. And she'd say, okay, look at the scene, because there were all these really cool paintings, the airplane dogfights and bullet holes and stuff. And I would draw the next scene, and then my mom would say, well, tell me the story behind it. And my dad had a box of paperbacks, a lot of the same books probably.
Could be.
And that's how I learned to read. So I became, other kids collected baseball cards, and I always wondered why there wasn't a George Preddy card or a Joe Foss card.
Oh, don't get Joe Foss is one of my favorites.
Yeah, I got to know him before he passed. So the real aha moment came when I was in the restaurant business and I had a number of employees and I saw the influence that I had on them. But I was young and I looked back and I'd been through all the executive training stuff and was very successful technically. Maybe from a STEM standpoint, I was successful. But I felt like I didn't know what I was doing leading people. And so just chance, luck, as Colonel Bushong would have said, I got to know Bud Anderson. He was a triple ace in World War II, and he's still with us, a great American hero. And I had a friendship with him, and I asked him a question. I said, look, let's not talk about there I was at 30,000 feet surrounded by Germans. What I really want to know is you're 21 years old. And you're surrounded by these guys, and they're trusting you to lead them into combat. Tell me how you did it, because I've got partners, and I've got employees, and I've got colleagues and vendors, and I feel like my leadership ability just isn't there. So he started coaching me, and how many people can say they had a business coach of a World War II triple ace? But he said to me, he said, John, he goes, look, you get us to record the story of our combat story, and all you need to do is tell that once. But if you want to interview other old guys, and he used the term old guys, and ask those questions about leadership, about life, about what it takes to be an American or character, whatever, I'll open up my Rolodex. And he did. So a lot of these guys on the History Channel and I had their numbers. They called my house. We talked, and we got to know each other for years.
You know, now that Colonel Bushong is out of earshot, that John, when we come back, there's a question I want to ask you that he may not find so nice, but I'm dying to ask you this as a fellow history nerd. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to AmericanWarriorRadio.com. You can hear the podcast from Colonel Bushong and over 250 others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Also visit one of John's websites, oldguysandtheirairplanes.com. You can find his artwork at johnmollison.com, M-O-L-L-I-S-O-N. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined by John Mollison. John's a true professional. He's a tremendous artist, but he also does these wonderful historical videos as part of the package, if you will, of his Old Guys and Their Airplanes website. So, John, real quick, let me probably get ahead of myself. I want to make sure that Colonel Bushong was gone before I ask his questions, because I've talked to him. I've talked to Medal of Honor recipient Woody Williams, the last surviving World War II Medal of Honor recipient, Colonel Dick Cole, Colonel Doolittle's co-pilot on the Doolittle raid. And of my generation, John, I made the mistake once. I had one in the studio. I said, I'm talking to history. And you can imagine where they might have taken a little bit of an insult about that. I mean, it's not like they were the pharaohs or anything. But really, do you get the same feel? I mean, you're literally sitting there talking to, particularly that generation, the Korean War generation, and now, to some extent, unfortunately, the Vietnam War generation. But really, and I always consider my role, John, as a translator. I'm here to translate their stories to the next generation. Do you see a parallel with what you do there?
Yeah, I kind of. I'll tell you, it's intimidating as all get out. Like, the DFC Society has been a partner in this project right here. And they gave Colonel Bouchon a really cool award. And they take care of their own. And I've been fortunate to work with the DFC Society on a number of projects. We call them the Old Guys in the Airplanes debriefs. And it's a combination of educational kits that we provide and live Q&A and film. But it's really intimidating sometimes to be around them because they've done the things that the average person consider heroes. But I'll say this: they're average people. You know, Leo Thorsness, he had the Medal of Honor. He was awarded the Medal of Honor in Vietnam, and I had the opportunity to. You know, talk with him on a number of occasions. And that's the thing about an interview. You can talk to somebody for 90 minutes, but if you get to know them over a few years, you know, fix their cars with them, get to know their kids, their story becomes all the more important.
And I tell you, John, the one thing I've noticed over going on 9 years we've been doing American Warrior Radio, 300 interviews, the amazing amount of humility. You know, Colonel Dick Cole, they launched early. He's flying above the 200 feet above the Pacific Ocean, one-way trip, mm-hmm. don't know if they're coming back. And he describes that mission like I would describe you. I'm going to run down to the grocery store.
Right.
Brigadier General McDivitt, who was here at this event today, you know, Vietnam, orbited the Earth.
Right.
And he just chats with you like, yeah, whatever, just one of the guys. So that's refreshing. And I think you're right. It does facilitate a better storytelling atmosphere, if you will.
Well, I'll get back to Leo Thorsness. I asked him, you know, every picture I see with the Medal of Honor around your neck, it looks like a pain in the butt to wear. You know, you're not happy.
It's the burden.
And he explained. He said, well, first I got caught, meaning somebody wrote him up, and then the second thing is, so when you get awarded this, it becomes a mantle you have to wear, and you think about. You think about the burden that the Medal of Honor people or anybody, DFC or any great military award, it gives you a sense of responsibility. And that sense of responsibility, I remember when I'm interviewing them. And my goal is now I want to meet these people as people, not necessarily as heroes, because if you put them on a pedestal, then they're out of touch, they're out of reach. But if you can understand them as people, then the inspiration is far more palpable, at least for people like me, or maybe for you too. But I can tell you for me, I mean, I haven't done anything heroic. I've put me in the battle, I think I'd cry and run away. But when I can look at some of these people as just normal human beings, then all of a sudden I have a touchstone. Then I go, okay, at least I know what it looks like. The normal, humble human being looks like. And then I have a touchstone. If that's making any sense.
Well, it's inspirational. And I got to tell you, when I sometimes change of command season, you know, we've got a big Air Force base in our headquarters city. And, you know, they always say, hey, thanks for coming out and support us. But frankly, I find it inspirational. As someone in my line of work, in my day job, you know, I interact with a lot of folks that don't exactly build your faith in the human character.
Right.
But I go out there and I see these young men and women in uniform, and it recharges my batteries and inspires me.
Yeah.
And I will say, we all can do something.
Yeah.
You're doing it through your art. You're doing it through your films. I'm doing it through radio. But everybody hearing this message, wherever they are, can do something.
Okay, I want to interrupt real quickly, and I know we're running out of time, but this is important. Last summer, I got to interview Brigadier General Charles McGee, and he was a Tuskegee Airman. Mm. The power of that man's objective, reasonable courage is just cool. But General McGee expressed it like this. He said, you know, how you treat yourself is going to be how you treat your family. And how you treat your family is going to be how you treat your neighborhood. And how you treat your neighborhood is going to be how you treat your community. And how you treat your community is how you treat your country. And so what we're all doing is we're all learning how to treat our country. And we're all learning how to get along here. Now, right now in the headlines, we can go out and find a million different headlines that say we're not getting along. Well, then I think, well, how are people treating themselves then? I mean, we're angry, we're self-absorbed. What are we going to get? But when I meet these distinguished people, you don't get the anger, you don't get the self-absorption. You get a sense of vigor, like we're all in this together, and we all have a part to play. So, again, I can be around the guys with the DFC Society, and I can get intimidated really, really, really quickly when you hear what they've done and where they've been and what they've seen. But then you step back and you go, wait, that's an average guy or an average woman who simply responded with good character and a sense of, as Colonel Bushong said, hard work,
yeah,
and a sense of heart. And don't we want that for everybody in our country? I mean, you do it. You know, I like to think I do it. So it's we all just play a part, I guess.
Well, and hearing the colonel speak, I could have been a fighter pilot because I'm a little dinky guy.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't have put me.
You're
in
about
bombs.
3'4"
in the morning.
Yeah.
But one other quick question for you, John. I mean, do you feel? Well, two quick questions. Number one, the most important one. We unfortunately there's a clock that's ticking here for people like you and me, and I make every effort possible to get and find those World War II veterans and the Korean era veterans. Do you sort of feel that same pressure? And I mean, just the more, because sometimes if these stories don't get told, John, they'll be lost forever.
Yeah, that's hard to describe. And once they go, if you look at my challenge coin, I've got a phrase on there that I got from a Vietnam War pilot who was writing down his memoirs, and he asked me to review it. But it's when an old man dies, a library burns.
Wow, that's powerful.
I know. It just stops you cold. And you think about how many old men, old women that we know in our lives, and they know so much, and they've been through so much.
And so that, when I encourage that everybody can do something, one of the things you can do when you hear this broadcast, whether it's a podcast or someone else, if you know of a veteran who has not told their story yet or needs to be told, you know, send us an email, bbg@AmericanWarriorRadio. You can find John Mollison, johnmollison.com. Mm-hmm. Let us know, or, you know, check with your local newspaper. There's lots of great programs where they've got high school students interviewing those veterans. But please do something and get those messages out. John, your wrap, what else can folks find at oldguyswithairplanes.com?
Well, I'd like to announce real quick another project with the DFC Society that we're just starting up here. But on August 28th, the DFCSociety.org website and our Facebook and social media is going to feature our next Old Guys in Their Airplanes production, which is going to feature Colonel Robert Certain. He was the first POW of Operation Linebacker, December 18th, 1972. And it's going to be a fantastic story about failure, success, leadership, the Vietnam War, and what we can learn from it.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Again, please visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Over 300 podcasts you can find there. And again, no matter where you're hearing this, go to 390th.org. There's a limited number of these prints that are signed by both John and Colonel Bushong. It's a fundraiser for the museum. And trust me, they're actually quite affordable. Check it out. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, all policies and procedures will remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.